Welcome to Cardicast, a glam podcast brought to you by New Cardigan. Our July Cardi Party speaker was Lauren Ellis, Exhibitions Manager at Immigration Museum, Museums Victoria. Lauren spoke about racism, identity, and Australia, and then took the group on a tour of the Identity exhibition currently on at the Immigration Museum.
Recognize anyone here? This is one of those weird, like, how are we all colleagues and I've never met you moments. But hi, everybody.
So Lauren is
because I'm always at my desk.
You're at your desk. Yeah. So you're the manager for exhibitions at Immigration Museum.
That's right. Yeah.
And you're here to discuss racism, identity, and Australia.
Yeah.
As well.
We'll see how much we'll see how that we get through.
That's a lot to cover in one Cardi Party, I think.
We'll shoot for the first two at least.
That's right. So I wanted to talk a little bit about our Glam Blog Club. We're talking about identity this month. Has anyone posted already? Yes, Claire. Yes. Thank you, Claire.
Nathan Sentence did an amazing one.
Yes, yes, yes.
If you're not following him, follow him.
Yes, he's so good. Very good, very good. And he was talking about identity and being Indigenous in this country. And that
and
was
the glam
and the glam sector as well, which was a really good post to read, actually. I want to make sure that you all know about that, and actually I want to see everyone here posting. I'm a bit of a pushy person, but I find them really interesting, and this month is it's a really good month to talk about yourself, but yourself in the glam kind of world, and I think everyone's going to find that interesting to read about. So I'm going to stop talking, otherwise I'll keep talking all day. Let you have the floor. Thank you very much.
Welcome,
Lauren Ellis.
Welcome, everybody.
What's your name like this time?
And I'm actually going to sit down because, yes. In case anyone's wondering, yes, I am extremely pregnant and sort of slightly out of breath due to too much baby and not enough torso. So welcome to the Immigration Museum. I'm going to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land that we're meeting on today. So this site has a long, long, long history of multiculturalism. I'm going to acknowledge the Bunurong and Woiwurrung language speakers of the Kulin Nation, but this part of Melbourne has been a multicultural meeting ground for different language groups, different nations for tens of thousands of years. So really it's incredibly pertinent that we now have an immigration museum on this site, but it's also ironic because this is unceded land. We have no treaty with our First Peoples, and it's a hugely unresolved aspect of our history and our current status and identity. So it's very interesting having an immigration museum that sort of celebrates and interrogates multiculturalism on this site in that context. And this building in particular was once a customs house, so it has its own very complex, tense history with the settlement and the colonisation and emergence of Melbourne as a kind of economic capital. So I'm not going to talk a huge amount about that now. That is a whole Cardi Party in itself. Complexities of being a customs house on the banks of a river where there was, you know, first contact in this city just a few metres that way. But I recommend reading more about the history of Birrarung, the Yarra, and this part in particular, the Turning Basin, and the destruction of the waterfall that once separated the brackish and the fresh water, because this is really, you know, an incredibly interesting part of Melbourne, one of the most significant Indigenous sites, really, that whose history is virtually unknown. So, with that opener, is Australia racist? has anyone been listening to the It's Not a Race podcast on Radio National? If you haven't, it's just had its final episode for this series. It's hosted by a woman called Beverly Wang, who is fantastic. It's a really good series. And the final episode asks the question, is Australia racist? Or rather asks the question, why do we keep need to asking, is Australia racist? What is our obsession, our like pursuit of absolution from racism that we need in this country? And it's a really, really good episode. I really recommend it. And the whole series, in fact. But I guess I'm going to skip that question. We're going to start with a bit of an awkward pop quiz at the beginning of this talk about race. So I think let's assume that most people in this room would agree the question is more how is Australia racist rather than is Australia racist. But we as a country, our national media, continues to not be able to get past that first question. So straw poll, show of hands, I'd ask how many people in this room feel like race is relevant to their work? Okay, not everybody, interesting. How many people, I'm going to try and ask this without
sort of forcing anyone to be uncomfortably tokenized or outing themselves with one identity or another. How many people feel like they have a racialized personal identity, that their experience of moving through the world is racialized, or they identify with a race? Not many people. Starting to think, am I? I'm white, do I have a race? I don't know. Interesting question, we'll get back to that. I recommend a very interesting project from America called the Whiteness Project that has just changed its name. But that project, and I just can't think what the name is called, but that is by a researcher, a filmmaker really, but he does all kinds of work that tries to overt and unpack what is the white race, what is white racial culture. Who would describe themselves as being comfortable talking about race? I think that's very honest. I'm going to say it's generally in Australia, I don't think we have a high degree of comfort with this topic. People get nervous. What are some of the things, for those of you who didn't answer yes, if anyone's feeling, the recording is really killing us here. This is one which we should just turn it off, make blunders. One thing I will say, and after 10 odd years working in multicultural community engagement, you just have to be really, I'm going to try not to swear. Yeah, you can bleep out my swears. You have to be really comfortable with mucking up when you talk about race, because you will. Mm. We are not literate about race in this country. So be prepared to make mistakes, assume best intentions, and own your errors. And be aware that impact is more important than intent when you're having conversations about race. In fact, in life. What are some of the things that make you uncomfortable talking about race?
Coming from as a white person, coming from a place of privilege, yeah. And having a series like assumptions about or stereotypes or unconscious coming into a conversation, I've had to interview quite a few people from a variety of different races, and started into the conversation and then realised that I have absolutely no footing whatsoever, and it's coming from a place of a fairly narrow view and a place of privilege. So.
Yeah, heaps of ideas in that answer that are all, you know, worlds of study in themselves. But yes, so being aware of, that sounds to me like being aware of, like, I know I'm probably tokenizing and othering and stereotyping and potentially harming you, but I don't quite know how. And I'm aware of my privilege, but I don't quite know how to tone it down because nothing has ever taught me to do that. Yes, definitely. Any other answers that you...
So, for me, the term race has a problem. In New Zealand, we more talk about ethnicity because race has this horrible, loaded scientific baggage with it automatically. Others, everything, and has this idea that of not even one, like singularity, only being one race. So.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's one of the things that I was going to talk about, is the language around race, racialized different ethnicity. So you have this very shifting vocabulary around it, and part of it is hugely geographic. We in Australia and presumably New Zealand aren't very comfortable with the language of race. Race, as you've alluded to there, has a really complex, highly dodgy sort of pseudoscientific social history that I won't even start to get into, and I'm by no means an expert on. Do people feel comfortable knowing what is race, what is ethnicity, what is culture, what is nationality? Where do those things overlap and separate? I mean, there's no one thing I'll say here. These are not yes/no questions. These are complex, fluid things that are highly dependent on context, on geography, on social history and loaded meanings and associated meanings with words. And one of the big things that I think stops us having this conversation openly with our colleagues, or, you know, while we're not very good at it in the public sphere, but even at that sort of project team level in museum practice, is language is a huge barrier. So knowing what kind of... Is person of colour offensive? Should I not say colour? Is non-white bad? Because it means it's centering whiteness. Yes, I would say yes, probably. Don't use that word. Black people, brown people, minority people, marginalised people, Indigenous, Aboriginal, Koori, Wurundjeri, migrant, immigrant, new arrival. All of these things are very loaded terms that different people will hear really differently. And there's no magic solution here. I would say, just from my own experience, and as you will see up in the exhibition, there are hugely different regional, geographic, generational, and individual preferences about the language of identity. And there's no one right way to do it. And you'll probably make mistakes. A word like colour is hugely loaded and can be very offensive in some settings. But increasingly, you've probably heard more and more that language of person of colour, people of colour, is becoming much more commonplace in Australia. That's something that I think we've really inherited from the US, and it's language that is increasingly deployed in social justice, race politics, activism. But not everyone's comfortable with it. My biggest piece of advice, not that this is an advice session, I realise, but since we're all here, is, you know, where you can and where it is appropriate to, find out what does a person prefer. Try to be as individual and specific as possible, but often it's very hard to do that without asking someone to really overtly identify themselves in a way that may be very like rushed and inappropriate and insensitive depending on your exchange with them. But I think listening first and trying to use the language of whatever community or individual you're working with is a bit of a skill, tuning your ear into that. And the more and more you read in this area, the more practice you get at kind of working out what's a bit of a language, what's my vocabulary working in this context. You've mentioned privilege. That is a really important one, and it's one that is really important in the exhibition. Does everyone feel like they have a good working definition of the word privilege? And does anyone want to offer their explanation of it? Anyone bravely? That's okay. I won't put you on the spot. So, I mean, I would say there are lots of definitions, and it's like all of these things, shifting sands constantly. But let's say it's broadly like a set of unearned, socially conferred, exclusive benefits. And this idea, you know, white privilege is the one we hear a lot, but obviously this idea has been extrapolated into all kinds of different social, cultural, gender-based, economic degrees of privilege. And it's sort of originated from an American woman called Peggy McIntosh, who wrote an essay called Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack about white privilege in her career, which I really recommend as a kind of baseline reading. You know, another really important thing that needs to sit alongside privilege is a term that gets joked about a lot at the moment. It's kind of like the, you know, just never Google intersectionality meme or social justice meme because it's just full of completely horrible, offensive things. But intersectionality, you've all heard this word, and it does get used as a bit of a joke for like, oh yes, you know, here's more kind of self-important, neurotic identity politics of the left. But it is a really essential idea. Does anyone not know? Who wants to volunteer a definition of intersectionality or tell me a bit about what you understand it to mean? So this term was coined by an American activist called Kimberly Crenshaw. And again, I'm not even going to attempt a comprehensive definition, and I'm not an expert in any of these things. But it basically, you know, refers to the idea that any one person's identity or social position is fluid and lies at the intersection of lots of complex factors that may be different in any one context. So in one context, you know, I may be kind of socially privileged by my whiteness or my able-bodiedness or my economic privilege or my level of education. You know, this idea emerged from basically interrogating feminism and looking at how feminism has historically really worked for white women and has overlooked this whole slew of issues that are faced by women of colour. So it becomes really important in our identity exhibition because one of the core premises of this exhibition is that identity is made up of lots and lots of complex, nuanced factors, and something like your skin colour or your ability to speak the language of your family can both be, in some contexts, a tool or a marker of inclusion or exclusion. So the classic story would be the kind of second or third generation, let's say, Chinese Australian who doesn't speak the language of their parents and grandparents. So that may have been something that was really encouraged by their parents because, you know, there was a sort of anxiety about, we don't want you to be too Chinese, we want you to speak good English and do well in this country. And, you know, we meet so many people of that sort of experience who, you know, what it winds up becoming is a kind of barrier to their authentic engagement with their cultural heritage, or a sense of, you know, when I go and visit my Chinese grandmother, you know, I feel a lack of, there's a limit to how deeply I belong in that space. But likewise, out in the white Australian mainstream, I'm limited by how much I am seen as belonging in that space by my visible difference. So this, all of these things, this is a very swirly, messy description of some of these key concepts that are really important to have under your belt when looking at exploring broadly race and identity politics, but certainly our exhibition when we get upstairs. How are we going for time? One thing I'll just ask at this point, who is feeling at this point like, man, this is so heavy, like I'm feeling, is everyone okay? I was like, do we need to talk about white fragility yet? Are people familiar with fragility as a concept in identity politics? So this is also by a white educator. I'm going to say as someone who works in the space of trying to amplify and centre marginalised voices, which is sort of core to my practice as a community engagement specialist in a museum about cultural diversity, I generally try to make reference to as much as possible or amplify the voices and ideas and acknowledge the ownership of ideas or the creation of ideas by people of colour. And I've twice now referenced a white writer in this session. So I'm sorry, that was Peggy McIntosh to start. And white fragility comes from an American educator called Robin DiAngelo. And I really recommend looking at this. It's to give it an incredibly unfair brief summary. It basically describes the lack of stamina that, on the whole, white people have never developed, or they've never developed the stamina to stay in sustained conversations about race and power and privilege. And what you see is a kind of typical expression, a sequence of behaviours, which is sort of feeling put on the spot, feeling attacked, becoming defensive, desperately clawing for the good inside themselves, justifying, arguing, nitpicking back arguments, undermining and questioning the validity of kind of the experiences of that are being reported to them. Anyway, that's a whole other thing. But the point is, something I would say that is really, really important and that this exhibition has really tried to do is emphasise that being aware of the systemic racism that is infused in our country or the racist behaviours that we might unwittingly participate in or the inherited biases that we have don't make any one of us, going to make a broad optimistic assumption about the people in this room, doesn't make any one of us a bad person. They are just systems that exist. They're systems with a social history that is, you know, to some extent overted in an exhibition like Identity that we have inherited. And especially if you're part of a dominant group, whether that's culturally dominant or dominant by gender or education or economy, they're often systems that are utterly invisible to you. So this is really just a process of critical thinking. It's a process of starting to analyse and unpack things that don't make you a bad person, but they're systems that you've inherited and are worth, in a sort of social justice, making this world a safer and more inclusive place for everyone project, they're worth exploring and unpacking and trying to do better on most of the time. And that's really one of the core objectives of the exhibition. So we might just go up there in one second. I'll just give you a little bit of context for this exhibition. The Immigration Museum opened nearly 20 years ago. It is obviously a museum really focused on cultural diversity, multiculturalism, and for the first kind of 10 or so years did that really through a narrower lens of looking at migration history. So looking at, you know, the kind of timeline of immigration to Victoria, these big iconic waves of immigration linked to things like the gold rush and post-war Mediterranean migration and, you know, 1970s Indochinese boat people, refugees, looking at different overlapping eras of policy and implementation. So, of course, famous examples, you know, around the White Australia policy and different eras of nation building and 1970s kind of multiculturalism as the project. And, you know, more recently, potentially, I'm just going to choose my words here as a public servant, potentially a shift away from that very, you know, deliberate kind of language of multiculturalism of Al Grespi in the 1970s. So we've got, that's sort of the first floor of our museum, which you're welcome to stay on and look at or come back another day. About, I guess, 5+ years ago, we started to look at, well, how can we more broadly look at, okay, well, so given this migration history, given the resulting cultural diversity, particularly of Melbourne and of Victoria, how can we take a more thematic, broader look at that? You know, what are the kinds of issues and ideas and, you know, benefits and challenges, and what are the kind of, you know, existential questions we're grappling with as a culturally diverse, cosmopolitan, you know, modern community? So this is really where the idea for identity came from. And it's, you'll see that it really tries to provide a beginner's toolkit to unpack things like all the aspects of identity politics around race, ethnicity, visible difference, language, heritage, inheritance. And importantly, it was designed for secondary school students, so that's its kind of core audience. But I would say our experience is that lots and lots of adult visitors get a lot from it. And what your own experience of having either a racialized or a kind of othered identity experience in the community is really informs, in our research on the exhibition, really informs how you receive it and what you tune into in it. So just bear that in mind. I'll just briefly give you a sense of the themes that we'll kind of look at. One of the big themes that applies to the whole museum and has really been a bit of a linchpin of the exhibition is the idea of being and belonging. Who belongs and who doesn't belong? When do you experience belonging, or when do you feel a sense of exclusion, and how might that change in different contexts for different individuals? And that premise is really set up by the first experience, which I recommend you kind of slow down and spend a bit of time in. But in the entrance corridor, there's a projection by the filmmaker Lynette Woolworth, and that tries to set up a very kind of immersive, emotive, personalised experience of feeling welcomed or feeling judged or feeling excluded. And that really kind of is the sort of tone for the whole exhibition is, you know, who belongs, who feels a sense of belonging, where do they feel that, when and why? What are the factors that, you know, tune that feeling of belonging in and out? Then it sort of moves through some of these basic ideas around, you know, visible difference, and importantly, starting to get you, and especially imagining if you're a secondary student, to overt and recognise in yourself the implicit kind of biases and assumptions and prejudgments that we make of each other that, again, don't mean you're a bad person. Everything in our social training teaches us to do this. We do it totally subconsciously. And I really recommend for anyone who's interested in this, there's an online resource called the Harvard Implicit Association Test. Sorry, Harvard University. Has anyone taken it? And it sort of tests your bias around, like, do you have a preference for light or dark-skinned people, for, you know, hijabi women or for unveiled women, lots of different versions of it. But it's an incredibly revealing test, and don't be upset by the results. In a majority white country, it is very, very, very hard to grow up without these messages infused in our very being. Everything in our media, you know, is reinforcing a set of messages, although, of course, they are changing over time. Then the next couple of things in the exhibition that it tries to do is present a bit of a social history for racism, and looking at, you know, how that history is contested, how that history is more upsetting to some people than to others. And there's one really great case called Lighten Up that kind of looks at cultural appropriation in advertising and in marketing and in comedy and in media and pop culture, or cultural mimicry, you know, things like the Wog Boys, or through to, you know, like Redskin lollies, that kind of thing. So bearing in mind that this exhibition is 5 years old, you know, that idea of cultural appropriation, which is such a hot topic now, and I'm sure everyone here has read columns and, you know, think pieces about cultural appropriation, either being like political correctness gone mad, or like, yes, actual, genuine, you know, race-based or cultural-based harm. These were relatively kind of unusual ideas to the mainstream, certainly to, I would say, your average high schooler student when this exhibition was created. And then the last thing the exhibition tries to do is provide some starter tips for, like, what is practical action that you can take if you want to be a kind of force for good in anti-racism work in Australia. So things like, you know, one thing you may have heard of before that you'll see upstairs is a tram installation where an encounter takes place and you have the option to watch the encounter from a series of different perspectives. And it gives, in the text and in the you know, scenario that unfolds, it sort of tries to give you an insight of what's it like to be the target of a racist microaggression, or in this case, not so microaggression. What's it like to be another marginalised or minority or person of colour watching on and watching it unfold but not being the target in that moment? What's it like to be part of the kind of culturally safe dominant majority in that scenario watching on? And I'm sure everyone has had that experience of seeing something happen and thinking, should I say something? I'm only going to make it worse. Am I going to seem like a white saviour? How do I do it? I should just stay out of it and let it blow over. And so it kind of examines that little thinking process, but actually gives you, based on research from the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission, kind of tips for what they most recommend is the best thing you can do. And again, you know, it's not straightforward. So maybe now, since I've been talking for a long time, does anyone want to ask a question? Or we could go up to the exhibition for kind of 20, 25 minutes and then do a quick reconvene. And I will give you a couple of insights from research that was undertaken through the ARC, with led by Deakin University, but also with Melbourne University and our staff here, that evaluated the impact of seeing that exhibition on secondary students. Does anyone want to ask a question first? Or are we all like, phew, I haven't done anything really racist. This is good. So I realise I didn't also talk about the making of this exhibition very much, and I'm sorry if people wanted to know about that. I will briefly mention that a really core way that we work at this museum is, as you've probably seen here and all through the rest of the museum, is like exploring complex global issues through individual local stories, and that's very much the model that we used here. So there's a huge amount of kind of community consultation through to sort of deep community collaboration and co-creation. This project had guest curators on it. We do a range of different, I guess, degrees of co-creation on the spectrum of, you know, from ranging from sort of consultation all the way through to kind of your individuals and community groups really driving the direction. And this sort of sits somewhere in the middle, of, you know, based on its kind of scale and length of its installation. But you can see there's lots and lots of, you know, real individual stories that are represented. I'll just briefly refer to, like I said, the research that was done onto the impact on students. So that research document is online and it is very long and complex and comprehensive. So I won't go through it in detail, but I just wanted to mention a few things that our research indicated from students who come through this exhibition with their school group. It helped them to kind of understand with a bit more of a kind of toolkit of a language and examples what it means to live in a multicultural society. But we found the ways in which students kind of resonated with or engaged with the exhibition hugely depended on the degree of diversity in their school or in their personal experience. So the experience that, say, you know, a young Fijian student in a highly culturally diverse school had moving through this exhibition compared with a young kind of white Anglo student in a predominantly white area had was really different in terms of their results. And that's unpacked a bit in the report that's online. And often students that came from a less diverse geographic area and school tended to focus on less sort of, I guess, racialized differences and more differences that we might associate with kind of subculture or personality. So very much cluing into things like tattoos and football scarves and leather jackets as indicators of kind of, you know, identity and belonging or exclusion. This exhibition has been a really good tool for students to kind of see experiences they've had reflected and overted and kind of crystallised into a sort of idea for them. So there's a lot of the student feedback is around like, oh yeah, that reminds me of this thing that happened to me when, you know, da da da.
And broadly, the results show that students did have a really enhanced and heightened understanding of diversity and the challenges and of the issue of racism in Australia, where it comes from, how people experience it, and how you can be a kind of positive force for social change. So that's great. One of the big, limitations, and if we had our time again, this piece of research will be, you know, when we have our time again to redevelop our next big exhibition that tries to tackle this sort of topic, is doing some foundation work to unpack privilege and cultural dominance. And the reality of that in Australia is that, you know, the shorthand is whiteness. I've used whiteness as a shorthand a lot through this talk, and that's just because of the speed at which I'm going. Whiteness is obviously a really complex thing, you know. It's not one thing. You might be of Turkish heritage and nationality and perhaps citizenship, but living in Australia, speaking English and identifying as white and Muslim and Turkish, it can, you know, it means many, many things to many people, depending on your experience. So I apologise for the shorthand there. But one of the things that has been a criticism from especially kind of white Anglo students, I'm using this because this is sort of the way they describe themselves, is that they feel that their representation in this exhibition is one that's very negative, like that they're always the perpetrators of racism. And what probably needs to be done is more work unpacking that kind of assumption. What we don't see, because we see it as, you know, too often as a kind of cultural neutral position, but what is in fact, you know, a cultural group, a social group. So that's a big complex thing that is discussed a bit more in the report. Finally, I guess the thing that we were just talking about in the corridor that I didn't talk about very much, but I'll just touch on really briefly, is the diversity problem in our workforce and the challenge that presents for GLAM organisations trying to move into the space of addressing diversity, culture, you know, race and all other types of difference as well. Like, I very much focused on kind of visible difference, race, culture, ethnicity, language. But of course, there's a whole world of this under things like gender and sexuality, under things like, you know, education and literacy and economic background, you know, all these many different axes of kind of either marginalisation or empowerment, depending on the context. So, there is no easy answer to that, and that's a whole other talk that we could have another day. I think it's something that our sector is starting to turn its attention to, that the nature of our business, that it isn't brilliantly well paid, that it often requires a lot of free labour to get an entry pathway in through a free internship or volunteering for a zillion years, doing very expensive university degrees, and the expectation that you will have incredibly expensive kind of masters and beyond qualifications under your belt before you're a junior burger kind of customer service officer in, you know, the big organisation grows with every new big, again, you might need to edit this a little bit, but, you know, with every new university complex structure, you know, that's churning out these kind of qualifications and graduates, what we wind up with is a very undiverse workforce, and we as a sector are not very good at creating culturally safe spaces for marginalised people, and we're not very good yet at, not to say we don't ever do it, there's great work being done here, and indeed at Museums Victoria, you know, there are some really good examples of it, and I'm really lucky to work with some amazing colleagues who are doing lots of good work trying to push this change in our sector. But how do we actually create pathways for people with different backgrounds, and often they're different backgrounds that are closely connected therefore to their economic position, to come up through our sector? And it's really important that we do this because, you know, as we were just discussing, if our organisations are going to remain current and relevant and meaningful and keep our doors open as our social demography changes rapidly, we need to understand our community, and the only real way to do that is to have them reflected and represented in our workforce. So that's one for next time. I think there's a bit of a, let's say there's a perception or an anxiety that developing a diverse workforce means spending time and money to develop up skills that you could just buy in with somebody who looks the part. I would argue optimistically, never having run a large organisation, I can say this. that's not the case. You know, I think that it's an investment in the future of your organisation to employ and create pathways for diverse people to come up. Again, I'm doing really lazy language here of using diverse in the sense of like other than white. It's hard to do a conversation like this quickly without resorting to these very reductive binaries. And you're right, you know, then there's a whole other layer again about like social political groupthink that happens in our organisations as broadly kind of, you know, socially minded left-wing organisations. That's a whole other layer. And you know, I won't reel them all off now, but I think this is something that our sector is just starting to turn its attention to. I don't know if anyone saw or was at the conference in Brisbane, Museums Galleries Australia conference in Brisbane, which is an expensive thing to go to. So that's another, you know, it's a privilege if you're able to get there and pay for that. But there was a really interesting paper there presented by Nikki Sullivan and Craig Middleton from South Australia about a queering the museum project. You know, and that's a whole another sort of investigation of, you know, if your community is not seeing itself represented in your organisation, how relevant and current are you going to be? And how is the way that you can start introducing those narratives and those representations in a way that is meaningful and authentic and doesn't tokenise and doesn't, you know, place this expectation of emotional labour on different minorities? But you're absolutely right. It's really about picking, you know, according to context, according to project.
We do have to wrap
Yes,
up.
Sorry.
Really, really sorry. Are there any final points you wanted to make?
No, that's it from me.
No.
If anyone wants
to get in touch with you, is there a best avenue for that if they want to have a bit more of a conversation or talk to you about what's been going on here?
Absolutely. I can give you my email address get in touch with Nick and I work together. Yeah. So,
we can do that for sure. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you very much for coming.
That was our July Cardi Party featuring Lauren Ellis, Exhibitions Manager at the Immigration Museum. We hope you've enjoyed this live recording and would love you to review us on iTunes. It does help other people to find out about CardiCast and lets us know we're on the right track. Keep an ear out for more CardiCasts. Check out our website at newcardigan.org for more events. And remember, folks, JFDI.